Hey, okay, so Lucas and I are here again for, we're going to do the second chapter of Software, or Software rather, A Novel Theory on Power Projection and the National Strategic Significance of Bitcoin. That's Jason Lowry's thesis. We have it in PDF, and we did the first chapter last conversation. We're doing the second chapter here. The second chapter is purely methodological. It's an account of the methodology that Lowry uses for his thesis. On Twitter, Lowry said, hey, you might want to skip that chapter. It's purely formal, it's purely something he had to do for like the thesis requirement. He had to talk about the methodology he used. But I think Lucas and I agree that it's really interesting in and of itself because it, I mean, what's really interesting about Lowry's thesis is that it comes from a perspective military theory that we usually don't see. That with Bitcoin, we often see monetary, financial, economic theory used as kind of a jumping off point for hypotheses or claims about Bitcoin. And Lowry comes from a completely different perspective. And so in this methodology chapter, I think we get kind of a meta perspective of how we could take new angles on any subject matter, but more specifically on Bitcoin. And on that first point, like, I think that's inherently interesting too. Like, one of the things that's interesting about Bitcoin is it is a jumping off point into other things. Like, people who become interested in Bitcoin, often Bitcoin is hope, and hope is kind of, it fosters curiosity, right? Because you begin to look at the world again with new eyes, and you want to learn about things. The monetary system is no longer this opaque cabal that does things without our knowing or whatever, right? It becomes, we see that this open, transparent protocol makes other aspects of our lives more open and transparent too. And I think it does foster curiosity. And so this chapter, it's methodological. Maybe it's dry in that sense, but I think it's indicative of the what Bitcoin brings to us as far as a re-engagement with things that we can learn about and from whatever angle. And so this is one methodology we could use. And I'll just lay out the kind of the general summary of that methodology, and then Lucas and I will talk about it here. So it's grounded theory methodology, which begins with data instead of theory. So usually, you know, you could start with a general theory, and from that general theory, you could deduce a hypothesis, and then you could test that hypothesis. For example, you could say, you know, you'd have a theory that Bitcoin is a monetary technology, and you could deduce hypotheses relating to that about Bitcoin being money. But that's kind of been problematic because then you're already starting from a particular theoretical perspective. So grounded theory allows you to work the other way around. You begin with the data, and then you derive or get to a theory from that. So you begin with data, you then organize or code that data into different categories using concepts. And it's kind of a process of increasing abstraction as you create these categories that organize the concepts that you've derived from the data. And as you analyze data according to these concepts and then abstract them into categories, it's also an iterative process where you, once you have concepts, you then go back and get more data and analyze that data. Once you have categories, maybe you refine your concepts and then also go back and get more data. And it's kind of iterative until you get to the point where you've sufficiently abstracted your categories, kind of that broadest organizing principle of your analyzing of the data, into what are called core categories. And from those core categories, you generate explanatory, you make them sufficiently explanatory such that a theory emerges from that. That's a point called theoretical saturation within the grounded theory methodology. It's the point at which you really kind of finding new data and analyzing it doesn't generate any new conceptual insight that would then lead to a new category. You've kind of done enough analyzing of data to get the concepts and categories needed to inductively arrive at a general theory. So how that began here is Lowry had a kind of a general idea. You begin with a vague question, and this kind of, that's going to guide your analyzing the data. You have to begin with something. And the vague question was kind of something like, what are the national security, strategic security implications of Bitcoin? And then from that, he analyzed the data, generated concepts. From those concepts, again, he created general categories to organize those concepts. From the general categories, iteratively, he went back, looked at the data, came up with more concepts, refined the categories. From those categories, there was a process of abstraction to create kind of core categories that organized all of it. from this core, the core category that he alighted upon through this methodology, this grounded theory methodology, then was the power projection emerged as this like central category. And under this central category, there was power projection in wild nature, power projection in human society, and power projection in cyberspace. And then underneath power projection in cyberspace is kind of the theory he generates, which is that Bitcoin is a form of physical power projection into digital space. So that's kind of a broad overview of this methodological section and how he kind of tips his hand that this is the theory that is generated from all of this engagement with the data, analyzing it, coming up with concepts, organizing those concepts into categories, arriving at core categories, finding that core category of power projection, and then the subcategories under it of power projection in nature, human society, cyberspace, and then again, the theory that is inductively arrived at, or that I guess the theory itself is inductively arrived at from looking at all this data. And that theory, again, is something like Bitcoin is a form of physical power projection in the digital space. So that's a summary. Is that kind of what you got from this, Lucas?
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of things that really, I think, stood out to me that clarified, A, the value of this approach just in general, but B, the specific value of this approach for Bitcoin. Like you mentioned, there's so many jumping off places, and to quote Larry Lepard, the fix the money, fix the world. Once you understand Bitcoin, you start to see it everywhere, and you start to see how it impacts everything. And you go, oh, well, we won't have to fight forever wars because we won't be able to raise infinite money out of nowhere. So there's a benefit. And then you go, oh, well, companies can actually focus on innovation instead of chasing growth because they won't have to overcome a 12% cost of capital because the money is being inflated away. And you think, things are going to cost less because there's going to be fewer intermediaries and people in between taking transaction fees. And so specifically for Bitcoin, this interpretive grounded theory approach is absolutely wonderful. And the interpretive part where you get to bring your own bias, which is something that has always been no-node and poo-pooed when doing research, is actually brilliant because you think about what value do you have to bring a new perspective, a fresh perspective to something. You know, I think about like you go, well, here's this thing, and we need to determine the usefulness of it. And let's say this thing is a smooth, rounded stick that's slightly tapered and has a bit of a bulb on one end. And one guy goes, oh, that's a baseball bat. I hit home runs with that. And another guy goes, oh, that's a murder weapon. I kill people with that. And another guy goes, well, that's firewood, and I keep my family warm with it. And you bring a different perspective based on the experience that you've had. And when I was in college, I was involved in a little bit of research, some economic stuff and some agronomy. And reading a methodology section should be boring. It typically would be boring, but to me, it just hit me like a light bulb because I realized like just how short-sighted, limited, and truly potentially dangerous the hypothesis approach can be. And give you an example. Let's take OxyContin and let's ask the question, does it reduce pain? Yeah, it does. It does. That's great. It does that. And now we're done with the research and we've failed to look at the overall body of data, which also shows that it ruins lives. It gets people addicted. It creates havoc throughout a society.
Yeah.
You know, think about Ozempic. Does Ozempic and Wegovy, does that help you lose weight? Absolutely. It helps you lose weight. That's great. We've answered that question. But what we haven't considered is there's long-term effects. It's going to cause muscle wasting, and you're going to be probably dependent upon this, and, you know, it may change your brain chemistry as well. You know, all these different things. So to be able to come at a research question with this qualitative approach, and to use the benefit of your life experience as bias in order to give you kind of and to use that introspection that you have and go, mm-hmm. oh, that makes sense to me. One of the things that I thought when I was reading this was he talks about like some of the drawbacks of this approach. And one of the drawbacks is that it can kind of be like overwhelming, and it can kind of be almost, you know, there's just so much data and you don't, it can be frightening is the way that he put it, in that you may not know what you're going to find.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to go through that iterative process of putting things into categories. And
yeah.
What that made me think of in my interpretive approach is, you know, so I've been involved back on the family farm helping out and trying to kind of clean things and order things up. And I realized by doing that, that the most effective method in order to clean a farm shop is not to pick this up and put it away. It's to literally take everything out, put it into piles, and then start refining those piles. And first you go, okay, this yeah, is, yeah. you know, this is air equipment. This is, you know, and then this is, here's stuff that you beat stuff with.
Yeah.
These are hammers. And then here's stuff that are wrenches. And then you,
that's interesting.
You
cause that's
continue
like a material,
to refine
literal
those.
Example of the methodology.
Yeah.
Like, you know, literally the data is the piece, the object. And then the concepts are, you kind of understand the, you subjectively describe the tool, the item to yourself, and then you group those according to that. And through process of abstraction, you come to categories about where you're going to store things and stuff.
Yeah. Well, and that's the other part is that it's not only do you continue to refine it where you're like, okay, these are wrenches. And then you go, you know, these are open-ended wrenches. These are closed-ended wrenches. And here's your metrics and here's your standards and here's your big ones and your little, you got all that. But then you also, you go, well, where does it make most sense for me to have these? Like, is it on the east wall? Is it on the back wall? You know, this air equipment, like why would I ever keep my, impact wrenches on the opposite side of the shop as the air compressor? That doesn't make sense. Cause I'm going to have to walk across the shop. And so the answer reveals itself by ordering the data.
Yeah.
And there's so much value in that,
right.
To be able to look at this like the way that he did, which is to come at it with just, here's my bias. You know, I'm a guy that's interested in power projection and, securing resources because I'm a soldier. And this is my charge. So if I come at it from that perspective and I start ordering this data, what happens? And it turns out that he comes up with this novel theory.
And so, the thing is like, we don't, to kind of get the, like, I don't know, the gestalt of the theory and use it in our lives to get like the motivational force behind this. You don't need to sit down and do a formal thesis to apply a methodology like this. I mean, as you've described, you can even in ordering the, I mean, we kind of implicitly do it because it's a natural way of operating in the world. If you're intelligent, you take the data, you don't pre-commit to some theoretical framework about it, that all of the tools or items you're going to find in this garage are garbage. You're going to say, I'm going to look at each of the things and then kind of, as I look at them, I'm going to make subjective assessments about them, put them in the piles, and then refine my piles. So it's like something we do naturally, and it's good to see it stated formally as a methodology so we remind ourselves that in this type of qualitative endeavor, you do derive a theory that has some sort of value, even if it's not purely objective. There's a quote in here from a textbook dealing with grounded theory methodology, and I mean, it kind of gets back to first principles. I'll just read it because I think it's good. That noting that when you're dealing with qualitative data, you're only ever going to have that type of subjectivity involved as opposed to quantitative data. And so this is from Corbin and Strauss. Data collection and analysis have traditionally called for objectivity. Today, it is acknowledged that objectivity, as it is traditionally defined in research, can't be applied to qualitative research. The reason is that qualitative researchers interface with participants and the data. They bring with them their perspectives, training, knowledge, assumptions, and biases, which in turn influence how they interact with participants and interpret data. Instead of objectivity, qualitative researchers aim for sensitivity or the ability to carefully listen and respect both participants and the data they provide. And so I think this is, I mean, you mentioned this, like, we're each going to come to any new phenomena, take Bitcoin, with our own biases and perspectives. And what's liberating about considering from grounded theory methodology or kind of the principles behind it is that you don't, that's, there's nothing wrong with that. You don't have to say, okay, abandon all of those, now hit the textbooks on Austrian economic theory so I can learn what Bitcoin is. You can encounter it naively with your own naked eyes, bring to the table your own prejudices, assumptions, biases, and try to understand it. In that endeavor, it's obviously going to be helpful to look at every what people have said about it, look at other perspectives, but it remains to the case that I do think that it's liberating, and we shouldn't be ashamed to come at Bitcoin and try to understand it from the perspectives that we bring to it, and that that's going to lead to Bitcoin and art, Bitcoin and football, Bitcoin and this, Bitcoin and that, and that that's going to be really cool to see that explosion of people understanding this thing from whatever bias, prejudice perspective they bring to the table.
Yeah, and it gets stronger the more you approach it with different researchers. So you take the hypothesis approach, and what you do is you come up with a result that is, according to the scientific method, not false. You know, the scientific method, you can either prove things to be false or not false. They're never true, but they can just be not proven false yet. And if you have more and more researchers that attempt to replicate that, the best that they can ever do is agree that it is not false. But if you take this approach and you have more and more people come at it with their own personal biases, and they are approaching it with different facets, and they are coming to, you know, they're ordering the data and they're looking at it from their perspective, and they're coming to their conclusion because it's the data ordering itself that gives the conclusion. Then what you end up with is a result that, instead of the best you can do is say that it's not false, you can say it's more true. Mm-hmm. It's true from this perspective. You know, it's true from the soldier's perspective. It's true from the financier's perspective. It's true from the libertarian perspective. It's true from the individual autonomy perspective. Like, it's true from all of these different perspectives. And the more we bring bias to it, and the more varied those biases are, the more true the result that we end up with, instead of just reaffirming that something is not false.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we are constrained in doing that. We bring our biases, perspectives to the table, but we are constrained by logic, and we're constrained by, I mean, other people are going to have to be able to understand and accept our subjective evaluation as carrying some truth for them if they're going to also accept the theory that we deduce from the thing. I mean, if you say Bitcoin is a lizard and you have no logical reason to back that up, obviously it's silly. But the investigative, open-eyed attitude you bring to it is what matters, and we will get new perspectives and hopefully assess some of those as, like you say, more true than others. And Lowry notes that in the lessons learned at the end of it, he notes that one of the things that this approach requires is there's a specific character in the investigator that is required to undertake grounded methodology research in relation to some subject matter. It takes a humanistic bent, kind of creativity and imagination, but with a strong sense of logic, detail-oriented, got to be able to see the variation in the data to be able to kind of derive the concepts and then group things in categories, and a willingness to take risks and kind of live with the ambiguity you're always going to have when you do any sort of qualitative investigative endeavor, that especially is kind of drawing from lots of data, and you're tasked again with creating the theoretical framework instead of relying on it like a crutch. I think like a really interesting part about that is he notes it takes a humanistic bent, and you know, people can maybe sometimes be put off from something like Bitcoin because they think, oh man, now I got to learn computer code to understand this, or oh man, this is finance, I'm not a numbers person. But to note that you know, those are important skills that a person could have to tell us something interesting about what Bitcoin is, but that doesn't exhaust the field of people who have something to say to us about Bitcoin. Humanistic people, artists, philosophers, sociologists, military theorists, everybody who is in, who comes from a camp that is more based in the humanities than programming or, you know, financial theory, banking, or whatever, those people also have something valuable to tell us. And I like that thought, that it engages more people with interacting with Bitcoin in an intellectual way, or could, you know, engage more people to engage with Bitcoin in an intellectual way rather than just number go up or something like that.
Yeah. And I'm going to say something that goes along the lines of that stoner dorm room approach that we were talking about is such kind of the fun part of this, but it makes me think of beauty. It makes me think of Jordan Peterson's definition of what beauty is. And beauty is that which we all agree is beautiful. You know, there's a reason why this piece hangs in the Louvre and this piece does not. There's a reason why these types of characteristics are commonly viewed as beautiful amongst the population. And it's because everyone bringing their own personal bias to it is still drawn to it in a certain way. And Bitcoin is something that it truly does represent something beautiful. If you look at the code, it is beautiful in that it's incredibly simple and it addresses the problem and it does it in a manner that is so innovative and it draws this beautiful line between the physical and the digital world, and it marries them together in a way that could never be done. And then the way that it was conceived, you know, the Immaculate Conception was beautiful, where it was released into the world and it's decentralized and it's open for all. And what we see it do to people that adopt it, you see the people on Bitcoin Beach that were giving haircuts and taking payment in Bitcoin that are now millionaires. How it changes people's lives is beautiful. How it has united people. We talk about this, like, there is no more, we've been stuck in this hellhole of diversity, inclusion, and equity. I like how, I think it's Elon that calls it that, D-I-E, die, instead of D-E-I, but we've been stuck in this just toilet bowl of these words that mean absolutely nothing and truly represent racism and discrimination. But when you look across the landscape of people involved in Bitcoin, there is absolutely no more diverse, inclusive, or equitable group of people in the entire world than people that have seen Bitcoin for the beauty that it is and chosen to adopt it in their own lives.
I mean, we don't need to prejudge DEI as...
You're right. As all those things. I just throw that in there.
Because I want to say that, like, this would be interesting. Like, you can judge DEI by saying, okay, use that as a framework, as a vague intuition, go in, look at the data of Bitcoin, see what concepts from DEI you can apply to the data you're analyzing relating to Bitcoin, the nature of this thing, and then what categories emerge from that, and if there's a core category, and then, you know, let people who are so inclined see if they come at a new insight relating to when you look at a decentralized race blind protocol that is equally available to somebody in Nigeria and, you know, across Venezuela in the United States, anybody can get a banking account, or even without prejudging it as financial in nature, what does it mean that there's a proof of work protocol behind which everybody can shield their information? You know, what does somebody who comes in with the perspective of a committed DEI person, what will change about their ideology? Or maybe even, I mean, being open-minded myself, what will they bring something to Bitcoin? I don't know. It would be interesting. I would even, skeptical of some DEI things, I would say it would be interesting for a person who's committed in that way to bring their values to the table and honestly try to do data analysis, coding, conceptual refinement, category creation, and see if they can say something interesting about Bitcoin or about the values that they brought in to assess Bitcoin.
Yeah. I mean, what other thing unites drug dealers and senators and artists and engineers and
drug dealers and senators, you know, but I repeat myself.
Yeah, but criminals, but there, hey, I'm being redundant. Yeah, 100%. But yeah, I mean, what other thing unites people like that? I mean, it's like soccer. It's like, you know, it's like, it's like the, you know, the global sport, except it's the global liberator global and also perhaps the global protector. One of the things that I've been thinking about since we had our last conversation was you know, and he obviously mentions this, but just trying to put this into my own framework was, I brought up how I'm viewing this in terms of Bitcoin is the first live money that we've ever had. Everything else is simply dead money that is potential energy waiting to be released. And the way that it is released can be by purchasing a weapon that is turned into kinetic energy. The way that it is released can be by bribing someone in order to do something that you want, by paying someone to protect or harm in your name. But the thought that I had was just that dead money kills. Like, the only way for dead money to inflict power is to do something that is destructive to society. It can be a bomb in order to try to claim more resources. It can be a bribe in order to try and get a back around on something. But what the crypto, what the cyberspace battle of power projection does is it uses live energy, and there's no innocent bystanders. There's no casualties. It's merely a back and forth, a push and pull, where the superiority transfers to whoever can display the most power in a competition that is not just harmless to the participants, but instead of being destructive, it is accretive, because the more power that they are able to project, the better that they are able to serve their society and the people around.
Yeah. So, no, that definitely goes to the heart of... Can you hear me?
I want to make shirts that say "Dead Money Kills." That, I mean, because it's been running through my mind. It's just "Dead Money Kills."
Yeah.
You know, and live money gives life.
Dead money is after your brains. I mean, it's a zombie. But yeah, I mean, so that's obviously, you know, that's a good kind of, that is very consistent with Lowry's thesis, and so comes at it from a theoretical framework that he is kind of establishing here, power projection and the physical power that Bitcoin represents in cyberspace. I'm curious, Lucas, you as a person, if you could strip away your preconceived theoretical knowledge of Bitcoin and arrive at it now, naive as a child, innocent, but still bringing all of your world, all of your life experience to the table, your the jobs you've had, the rural background you've lived, bringing all those things to the table, can you put yourself in those shoes and come at Bitcoin again and describe what it is without recourse to military theory, banking theory, like monetary economic theory? What is it to a person who is you?
Yeah, what a great question. And how do you even come at that and try to leave those things behind? Because you know, like Saylor always says, you know, Bitcoin is on a need to know basis. Like, you'll know when you need to know.
Yeah.
And I think for me, it was that realization that, oh, this is something that works. Like, I think about this all the time, and I write about this too. I was a financial advisor who bought Barnes & Noble instead of Amazon. And I looked it up last night. The $2,500 that I put into Barnes and Noble that went to like nothing would be worth like $25 million now, if I'd have put it into Amazon. And I went to go buy Google when it IPO'd, but I wasn't able to make the purchase because the only person that I could find to sell it to me was a guy that was going to charge me $300 out of the $800 that I had for a commission. Mm-hmm. And I didn't trust E-Trade because it had just come out. And so I had this like experience of like, even though I was educated mm-hmm. and I was credentialed in that area, that I kept getting the things wrong. And the only thing that got me there was when I bought some Bitcoin, I got lucky and I happened to buy it like right when it was in a bull run, and it went way up like in a week, and I freaked out. I didn't know what it was. I still didn't understand it. And so I sold it just to make sure I could get my money out. And of course it never went back to that level, and I was never able to buy back in. But I mean, can I even come out? And I don't think so. The reason I don't think so is just because how many people have you tried to orange pill and how, like, what's your hit rate? You know, like, mine's probably 3%, maybe, if that, you know? And of that 3%, I wouldn't say that I've actually orange-pilled anybody. I was just able to trade on my reputation and their trust in me and get them to take this step for themselves, and they just see, oh, number go up, you know? And it takes... I could still, you know, you could break it down into all the different categories. Like, here's how it serves the four purposes of money, and here's the ten characteristics. And you could do that, but why would you? Like, how would you ever have that curiosity unless you had a need to know? That need to know for most people is when they're in the situation like Saylor describes, which is it was life or death for that company. And they needed to know, like, what can we do in order to save this company? It wasn't something that they were doing as like, hey, how do we just get better a little bit? It was like, hey, we're going to die. You know, and we're looking at that right now. Like, that's, you know, we're watching I think the debt just went over $36 trillion. And who knows? I don't understand why, but maybe $36 trillion seems to be kind of the magic number. Nobody cared when it was 27 or 22 or 33, but all of a sudden 36, and we've got the Bitcoin Act bill, and we've got an entire cabinet and a president that are pro-crypto, and it's like, oh, yeah, shit just got real. So maybe we should look into what the significance of the number 36 is. But
there's a Kabbalistic significance we can esoterically derive as, like, if time is a topology and not linear, then from the future, a message is being sent backwards in time through Kabbalistic significance of numbers. I'm reading Xenosystems right now, Nicolai.
Oh, yeah.
it's definitely a trip. So, but I would say, don't feel bad, like, that you bought Barnes & Noble instead of Amazon. I bought Booze and Books instead of either of those things. And I don't know that my investment has paid off except for kind of subjectively as something that I'm glad that I invested in.
Here's how prescient is this? 36 is the atomic number of Krypton.
There you go. Again,
Kryptonite.
There is significant numbers.
It's all preordained.
It's the future speaking to us. So,
yeah. So I don't know. I don't think I could. I genuinely don't think that I could come at Bitcoin from any way other than I did. But what about you? Is there a way that you and I, like, this is a great example. You and I came at Bitcoin from completely different reasons. I came at it from, probably greed, I would say, because I kept seeing a buddy of mine who I knew was very wealthy put stuff up, and I finally, like, talked to him, and he gave me kind of the in. But I think you kind of came at
it from the
academic humanitarian side.
Right. I was a philosophy major, so I never had wealthy friends. So
correct.
I never had to worry about wealth. It was not something that, like, greed would have been entirely hypothetical for me, that, oh, that's something you have if you have money. I didn't have the predicate to greed. But no, like,
what you have when you don't have money.
I mean, when you have some idea of the money you don't have. Like, well, in philosophy, it's like you don't get a skill that's going to make you wealthy, but you get the skill that makes you not care that you're not wealthy, right? That's
philosophy. Yeah, yeah. What is that? indignation?
it's a negative description of all of philosophy, but perhaps it's true. But no, so I was doing lawyering at the time of the human rights orientation, and so Alex Gladstein, like, so again, we're talking about different theoretical frameworks that one might have, and, like, the common ones, financial, banking, economic theory, and then with Lowry, military theory. Human rights could be considered also another, you know, orientation someone could have to Bitcoin, another theoretical framework from which a person could deduce hypotheses about what does Bitcoin, does it actually in X society lead to less oppression from an authoritarian government? And so Alex Gladstein's book, Check Your Financial Privilege, that really opened my eyes. And that was a theoretical framework that, I mean, it's not philosophical. It is very economic in orientation, but it is very value-based and ethical and oriented towards kind of claims about ethics within political morality of oppressive societies cannot sustain an open monetary protocol because of the way they operate, and more so like check your financial privilege. If you don't see why that's significant for someone in another country, it's because you've never lived in a country where you haven't had access to banking. Like, and so, you know, if you say, just get like Apple Pay or Venmo or whatever, it's like, well, these things aren't even available in certain countries, right? So you, but so in any case, asking myself that question I asked you, coming at this from the frameworks that were given to me, my own experience, the perspective I have, naively not considering Bitcoin as a monetary technology, it first arrived to me as a human rights technology, and I still see it as that. Like, that's what I see it as, and that is what, even beyond any investment thesis, that's what sustains my conviction. That's why Bitcoin is hope, and again, hope is what gives me curiosity, and it's this reinforcing feedback loop. And now I want to learn about banking and financial theory and all these other things because I want to understand why this thing works and the ways in which it's going to ramify. So, yeah, I mean, that's just given my philosophy background and the kind of human rights oriented lawyering I did. And then Gladstein's book really struck me and was a good theoretical framework for me.
Yeah. And I should say, you know, at the time that I was doing that, I was living this comfortable life as a banker, and I had a little money, and I was just like, how can I find something that will help me retire earlier? Because I don't want to do this. Like, I just genuinely wasn't enjoying. But concurrently, at the same time, I was sitting there and I was reviewing financial statements coming in from operations during 2021. After agriculture had just the most insane year ever. They had the best yields, they had the best prices, they got the biggest payments from the government that were just, I called it the Trump bump on the heels of COVID. And so, you know, they had all this money coming in, but I had so many operations that their entire net worth grew by 40%, but they couldn't pay their bills and they needed more credit. And then I had operations that were coming in that had literally never borrowed money, like people that literally did not have a credit score because they had never borrowed money before. And we had to figure out how to finance somebody without a credit score. And they were coming in asking for money. And I was like, none of this makes sense. Everything should be working. Everybody's getting more money. All of your ground just the real estate values went up 30% in a year, or 50% in some cases. We had irrigated ground that was going for $6,000 was then selling for $8,900, $9,200 per acre. And you're looking around and you're like, wait, I thought that was good. But if that's good, then why is everybody broke? And why is this not working? And why are we expanding lines of credit from $1 million to $1.5 million? And so having that perspective, where I was researching that, and that took me down the creature from Jekyll Island rabbit hole and learning about, you know, the Fed and learning about that kind of money. If not for that, just the simple number go up thing on my app was on Coinbase was not going to get me there. And the way that I know that, by the way, is because there's a whole lot of guys right now in the Wall Street Bets section of Reddit that are learning a terrible lesson about greed right now, because they're in there going, oh, this MSTR thing, it's way overvalued. We're just going to short the living hell out of it. And they are getting their faces ripped off right now. And nobody understands why. And it's because, yeah, they're coming at it from greed, but there's not something else. I mean, there will be when they go broke. And then it'll be a need to know basis, because they'll want to know what killed them. And what killed them was Bitcoin.
They're going to, they will transmute it into the facile knowledge of memetic contagion. They will assume that master is in Bitcoin or another meme. They understand memes. They will, on the lowest common denominator, interpret the phenomena. Hopefully they will have the curiosity to extend beyond that, but we'll see.
I don't know. The ADIQ memes are really getting it done these days. Like, they're effective. They are simple, and they are spreading like wildfire. I don't know. Yeah. So anyways, I think, for both of us, I think, maybe it's probably accurate to summarize that, you know, we got to Bitcoin the way that God or whatever it was supposed to get us to Bitcoin. You know, we found it because it was there for us, and there was nothing that I could do differently. And yeah, there was, yeah.
I mean, you're a curious person. You're a curious person. I mean, I am curious in some ways, and I think that it's nice that Bitcoin rewards virtue in that way. It you know, you come to it when you need, when the time that is adequate, correct for you, preordained Kabbalistically. But you also, it comes to you because you're engaged with the world. It comes to you because you're curious about things. It comes to you because you're concerned about preserving your value that you've accrued in your life. You're concerned about your family. And so it's nice when things reward virtue and virtuous behaviors, virtuous characteristics. And yeah, so there's one lesson, or there's one thing I also, this is kind of a meta point from this, but I wanted to, I don't know, end with this or at least say it, that Lowry notes that when you engage in grounded theory methodology, it takes a high risk tolerance for a theorizer. So yep, you're going, you have the data, you don't have a theory to guide you. You have to find that theoretical framework. And so you go out in the wild, into the wild of the data itself. That's not the data that's faceless without concept. I mean, there's a Kantian point in there, like without the concept, it has no name yet. It is nothing. And so you have to give it meaning. You have to subjectively kind of describe this data, come up with concepts that do that, then organize those concepts into categories, et cetera. And so you have to have this high risk tolerance. And it's also, at the end of the day, you are making something. What you're making is a theoretical framework. It's not a rocket. It's not going to save humanity, but you're making something. And like, I think we're entering the epoch of the makers, of people who, whatever you make, be it, you know, an emotion if you're an artist, maybe it's an idea if you're a thinker, maybe it's a theory if you're an investigator, but this is the epoch of makers. And I like that the grounded theory methodology is about making something that's non-material, a theory, but you make something. And like Lowry made something of value, this power projection thesis. And I hope, I mean, one thing that you know, this dry methodological section could do maybe is empower people to be elons of theorizing and come up with new theoretical frameworks and make something.
Yeah. I think about when you think about kind of the scariness of walking into that data without knowing, it makes me think of songwriting. And when I write, I typically tend to want to write about some of the more like darker subjects. And I've always held the belief that there is more in darkness than there is in light. You know, if you're faced with darkness, there could be anything in there. And your imagination will put anything in there. But if you shine light on something, it just simply is what it is. And so you think about like, oh, you know, I could sit down and I could write a song that is about beer drinking and driving trucks and chasing mm-hmm. girls, and all I have to do is, you know, start rhyming stuff with boots and jean shorts and tank tops or whatever. But this other idea where you're like, you know, I feel something that I don't like and it's unsettling and I'm not really prepared to manage it emotionally, but I'm going to try to write it down and see what makes sense. And that's, it can be scary because it takes you into something that when you're done, you may not really like about yourself, or you may not want it to represent what it actually does. It may reveal a truth that you weren't willing at the time to consider. But just like the data ordering itself, you know, just like cleaning out the shop and the tools getting put into order, they do reveal themselves for what they are. And, you know, going back to it, it's not coming up with something that's not false. It's coming up with something that becomes more and more true, the more you look at it. I'm just having done a little, just the tiniest bit of research, like it was truly just so eye-opening to consider this idea of what does it mean for research to take those blinders off and actually try to look at the forest instead of the trees.
Look at the trees in order to look at the individual trees.
Yeah, that's actually true. Yeah. Look at the trees so that you can see the forest, I suppose, is probably
or understand that it's not a forest, it's a other thing.
It's everything. Yeah. No, that's a good way to put it. So yeah. Cool. I don't know. I love the route that it's taken us down, and especially just, you know, again, reading a methodology section should be the most boring thing about a paper, but this, you know, it couldn't have worked any other way. And so it really did provide this deep breadth of coming at it from different facets to support what became a theory that didn't start as one.
Right. And that's what we have here, is a novel theory about Bitcoin and its strategic relevance. And that novelty is not possible without this methodology. So yeah, it was worth reading, definitely, this chapter.
100%. I'm glad we did. I appreciate Jason Lowry stepping into the comments and giving us trying to give us a pass on it. But
thanks, teacher. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, but super glad. You know, super glad.
No, definitely. Yeah.
Very revealing. So it's cool. Great. Yeah.
All right, that's all I got.
All right. So then next time we'll check out chapter 3.
Yes. Sir.
Chapter 3 gets us into kind of the meat and potatoes.
Meat of things, right on. Yeah.
Really, which is, let me scroll down here so I don't get it wrong, just in case there's people that are following along that are interested in how this works.
With bated breath, wondering what the name of chapter 3 is.
Yeah, exactly.
Themselves to look at a table of contents.
There are people that are too lazy to Google the PDF, so I want to say
there's no way if I was listening to a random podcast, I would. So
yeah, chapter 3, Power Projection Tactics in Nature, which I think is going to be fascinating. You know, it's got this
fascinating.
It's got a David Attenborough feel.
We've already read it, both of us. We know it's fascinating. It'll be good.
Yeah, it'll be great. So, appreciate it. Great conversation, and we'll do it again.
All right, thanks, man.
Yep, later.